This is Single Threaded. I'm Jen Creighton.
I am so grateful to have a friend like Rachel Neighbors. She's on the podcast with me today. If you don't know Rachel, you absolutely should go follow her on Twitter. She is a principal technical project manager in developer education on AWS's Amplify team. And you might have also known her from her previous work on the React team. Now, as much as Rachel has had these amazing experiences, she's done a lot of amazing work. We're going to talk about that for sure. I want you to know about Rachel. Every time I talk to her, she changes my life. And I don't mean that in like this huge sense. I mean, she shifts things for me in this really interesting way. She brings this perspective to me that I'd never heard before or considered before. Her wealth of experience like really backs up what she thinks we should be doing when we're, for instance, planning and preparing for our next role, which is what we talk about in this episode. She has a very unique idea of how you should go about that. And I cannot wait for you to also have your life shifted by Rachel. Rachel, welcome to the podcast. I am, of course, stoked as always to talk to you. We never not have a good conversation. Our conversations are always really, really good and insightful. So I'm excited for everyone. For the people who don't know you, you are prolific, actually. You have worked with Mozilla and the W3C on web animation. You have worked on the Edge browser at Microsoft, and you have been rebooting React and React Native's documentation at Meta. You've done a lot of very big, high profile work. And my question to you is, being where you are now in your career, having done all of this, what's your advice to your younger self?
Oh man, Jen, it's great to be here. Thank you so much for inviting me to chat with your wonderful audience here. And you know, it's weird. I think about this question all the time because I wish I'd had people in my life who would have encouraged me. When I had just started out in tech, I was very opportunity averse. Nobody explained to me, you know, like, why are you limiting yourself to the skill set you feel comfortable in? If you have this skill set, the job opportunities are like 2 times more profitable. I didn't have any insight. There was no levels.fyi where I could compare product designer to product manager or software engineer to, I don't know, project manager, for instance. So I didn't have any insight and I was just bumbling along. But the advice I wish I'd gotten, because I have gotten some good advice at different junctures, usually from like this wizened older woman from 20 years out who may or may not have been like a version of myself time traveling back in the future to show at a Pilates class and be like, Rachel, why are you so hung up on this guy? You got your whole life ahead of you. And like, I need more of that in my life. So at various junctures, I still look back and I'm like, why did I time travel back and tell myself, Rachel, just try this opportunity out? I was really opportunity averse because I came from a farm. I'd had a lot of bad luck growing up. I had some good luck too, but not a lot of great luck. My mom was a systems analyst, but we didn't have a working computer in the house. How did that happen? Weird, weird upbringing. But I figured it out. Like, I saved up my waitressing tips, got my own laptop, and I mean, I didn't get a car, but I did have a laptop, so that helped. And when I found myself on the career market, I had a couple of really amazing opportunities that I look back and I'm like, if only you had joined that startup in Silicon Valley back like 10 years ago, oh my God, your life would be completely different right now. Why didn't you do that? And part of that was because I felt like it was too risky to take those opportunities. But when I look back, like I actually tally up the risk that was involved, I don't know that the risk was as great as I made it out to be for myself. I may not have felt safe because, as you know, things were very hard. But if I'd actually ticked off the boxes of like, if things go poorly, well, what's the worst that could happen? Which, by the way, is probably the best thing you could ask yourself whenever you're presented with something you're afraid of trying or doing or seizing. What's the worst that could happen? Okay, what's the worst that could happen moving to the Bay Area for a job? I don't know. Maybe my marriage at the time wouldn't survive it. So is that going to kill you? It's not like we had kids. We had separate joint accounts. Wasn't going to be a problem. Okay, I move over there and the job doesn't work out. So there'll be another job over there somewhere. You can always come back. You know, there's no decision that can't be unmade. Might cost more in time or money to unmake them, but pretty much there are very few one-way doors in life. There are things that look like it, but usually that's a lie. The exit's just on the other side of the building somewhere. You can get back out if you want. And that is what I didn't know when I was in my early 20s. Everything felt so big and imposing and permanent. And I look back and I'm like, Rachel, you could have gone to college for computer science if you wanted. You didn't have to be on the treadmill working every day. You know, 4 years of computer science, you would have popped right out after the recession. And you could have earned 4 years worth of work in one job, 1 year, one place. And these are things you only really see in hindsight. But if I'd had more of an attitude of, you know what, I'm going to bet on myself. I'm going to bet that I'm going to find my way out. I'm going to throw myself in the deep end and I'll find my way to the other side. If I had made more bets like that younger, things would be very different right now. But now I'm older. I know I have what it takes to get to the other side. I know that the best bet I can make in any situation is to bet on myself. I don't need to wait to be chosen or picked or have some, you know, celebrity hiring manager believe in me and pick me from the crowd. I don't have to be the chosen one. I just have to look and say, yeah, I'm going to climb that mountain. If I get stuck, call a rescue party.
There's so much there that I identify with, like highly identify with. Everything in your 20s feels like it's going to be permanent. I think you get a lot of feedback in your late teens as you start to maybe move into college or start to figure out your direction. And then through your 20s about that you can't undo things later. And that's just, as you said, absolutely not true. And then also the risk aversion, which by the way, as humans, we are really, really terrible at assessing risk. Like just overall, we are really poor at it. And I think that's really something to take to heart and recognize about your experience as a human is you are bad at this and you actually have to really sit down with the facts and figure out risk in a completely different way.
Absolutely. Risk analysis, like learning how to do risk analysis properly, is probably one of the best investments you can make in yourself. Like in your own trajectory, because this way, like so many people are going to try to swindle you by preying on your faulty sense of risk. Oh, well, you better put all your money in this thing because it's a safe bet. You better do this because if you don't, it won't be there. Like, oh, wow, housing is really good right now. Everyone's telling me that if I don't buy a house, you know, I'll have no place to live when I'm an old person. Hold up. Just because something is on sale does not mean you are obligated to buy it. If you know you're going to move in 3 years, you've just bought yourself an obligation. You've bought yourself a commitment. You've bought yourself into debt. And debt, by the way, is a liability. It increases your risk. So all the time, people are coming at you trying to prey on this sense of risk aversion in commercials, like your advisors at banks.
Yeah.
Everybody wants to make you feel like you're on your back foot because it advantages them. Even companies do this. I've had, you know, exit conversations where I had a better option on the table. And I've had people be like, oh, but you know, it's going to be harder for you to build up your network if you leave the company. You know, you want to be safe and be here. It's like, I built a network here. I'll build a network somewhere else too. You have to figure out how to analyze risk for yourself because other people will try to play you.
Also, other people just don't know you. I mean, there is some value in having a person who knows you really well and can shine back at you things you don't know about yourself. But ultimately, you know you still better than that person. They know some things that maybe you don't want to admit about yourself, but they don't really know your internal monologue. They don't hear the things in your head. They don't know when you feel anxiety about things and why. That's on you to know those things. And I mean, I had this experience earlier this year where I was looking at Netflix and I had another offer and some of the outside advice I got was to take the other offer because it was in my wheelhouse, which actually pinged me as like, well, then I'm not doing that. I'm obviously going to take the thing that's out of my league. And then the other thing was the Netflix job was so out of my league. I felt like I couldn't do it. And I had to have someone also be like, girl, shut up, which. Thank God they did. But yeah.
I find it interesting how you're saying out of your league and in your wheelhouse. You know that saying, do one thing every day that scares you a little?
Yeah.
I feel like as you're moving through your career, whatever thing you take has to challenge you in some way. when I took the opportunity at Microsoft, I did it because I'd never worked at a big tech company, and I really wanted to see the house that Bill Gates built, because the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation donated the computers that got me online first at my rural libraries.
Oh, wow.
So I really wanted to go see the house that Gates built. I now have opinions about the house that Gates built, but the point is that I got there, and it was intimidating. I had huge crisis of confidence while I was there. You know, like, am I too little? Everyone seems to know what they're doing. I didn't come from college. I haven't interned anywhere. I feel like I don't know the rules to play this game. But I learned, and I tried again. And now I have a saying, which is every time you move on to something new, it should be challenging on some dimension. Either it's challenging new organization. Oh no, it's a startup. I've never done startups before. Or it should be challenging. Oh no, I've never worked with quantum computing before. You know, like, there should always be something that makes you go, oh no. Because otherwise, you're just flatlining. You're just doing the same thing in different places over and over. How are you growing? In tech, we pride ourselves on loving the challenge, the excitement of learning new things. And it goes beyond just a different programming language or an algorithm. It goes for, like, interacting with new people, new places. I've worked in Amsterdam and London, you know? Like, there are all kinds of challenges out there. And as you move forward, you should seek a few of them out. Like, obviously, don't change all the things. You want to have a firm foot to pivot on. But we are smart people. You are a smart person. I feel like you could take on just about any challenge, so long as it's somewhere within the Venn diagram of your skills that you've acquired through many years of hard work and experience. Don't discount that.
It's really hard not to. Partially because, as a woman in this field too, you're not supposed to brag about yourself.
And that's why you ask other people to brag for you. Now, true story, having echo boards is really useful at work, you know, and in your community, having friends who are going to, like, sing your praises for you, because you are penalized for singing your own praises. You're written off as arrogant or braggy, or if you were a dude, you'd just be, like, really excited and proud. But no, you're supposed to somehow look down at your shoes and say, thank you for noticing me, senpai, whenever something remotely okay happens.
Yeah. And I haven't had that at a lot of jobs.
Echoes?
Yeah. The only time I have, well, not only time I have, but I mean, like, in my career trajectory, there was one point where I worked for a company. There was another woman who was a very, very senior level engineer. And when I joined the company, she took me around to everyone and introduced me and said, she's an expert in React. And at the time, I was not saying this to anyone, but she was. And so I got known for being an expert in React at that company because she did that for me. And then she would tell other people when I wasn't in the room.
You know, I do that when I'm introducing people to, this is my friend, they're known for XYZ. You should talk to them about ABC. You know, whatever your level, doing that is powerful. You might not realize that you can introduce your own manager to, like, an intern and be like, Sid here is an amazing person to talk to about GPU and graphic engine programming. You should totally get together and nerd out on that. That still means a lot. And it's good practice because you're not always going to be at the level you are. You're going to go up and you got to get used to spotting the things in other people that are worth crowing about and shining that light on them. I know it doesn't always feel like you're going to go up or you're going to have those opportunities, but it means a lot. And for the men who are in very privileged positions and listening to this, you can definitely do this and have a major outsized impact on the minoritized people, whatever group they're in. Honestly, you should just be doing this, period, for everybody.
Yes.
We're talking age, race, gender, background. Like, oh no, they don't have a college degree. You should be talking about how smart they are anyway. You know, there's so many different reasons why you should be thinking about what makes that person great and crowing about it when you're interacting with folks and you're introducing them. Because bias, we all have it, right? So if you don't say, you know, Jen here is an expert at React when you introduce her, the other person might be looking at Jen and thinking, with all their biases coming in, I guess this is what, like a girl, maybe a technical writer, I don't know.
Junior engineer.
They're making all these knee-jerk, completely hindbrain, no control over it, assumptions from how they were raised and the media they've been gulping down since they were babies. And you have a chance with this introduction in the first 30 seconds they've met somebody to completely knock that down and put Chen into the right category in their mental model where she belongs. You should be doing that for everybody.
Oh my God, yes. I've seen people, managers in particular, introduce underrepresented and marginalized folks without those credentials. And it's been very disheartening because it does, like, people have an assumed idea of you. Like, I often, like, if I get introduced as even an engineer, though, the idea is that I am just joining the field. I've been here 10 years.
Oh.
It's so hurtful. It's so painful. And that's why titles matter to a lot of degree.
Oh, yeah.
Right? I think the people who say titles don't matter are often men, white men.
Yes. And they're often like, what are they, this called? Like an equal among peers? What is the expression? But they're sort of like, oh, such a big deal that you already know their name. So you wouldn't ask about their level. You just assume that they're like staff or something because they've been around forever. And they're like, I don't know why people need to use engineering titles. Let them eat cake titles. Yeah, it's like, all right, Marie Antoinette, we all know your royalty. Get out.
You said something about, you don't know if the opportunities are coming, like that you will eventually move up the ladder, but you don't know that those opportunities are coming. And you have a very unique perspective on those opportunities and what you should be doing to find them. You gave this talk at You Got This, and the talk was about preparing for your next role. And one of the things that you talk about is that you don't wait until you're ready to leave a company to seek out your next opportunity.
Yes. This is something I used to do when I was earlier in my career. I would work at a place until I was completely fed up, and then I would start looking. And I mean, I've heard a lot of people say they'll try to fix the problem before they'll start looking, which, you know, fix, there's a difference between telling your manager there's a problem, please fix it, it's your job. It is their job. If they can't fix it, they're not doing their job right. You need a different manager. Just saying. Don't let your own career falter because somebody was a bad manager on your watch.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so like you can tell them, fix it. There's a problem. What can I do to make it better? What are you doing to make it better? Or, you know, there's the other thing, which is where people are like, I'm going to try to workshop the dynamics of my teams. Maybe it'll be a less toxic place. I'll do it all alone. I'll invest all this emotional energy. It never works. Nobody puts on their resume, I turned a toxic team around by workshopping it to death and investing a lot of myself in it. No. Your duty stops at being the best you can be and letting your manager know what you need to do that. You don't have to go any further than that. You have no obligation to. And it can be hard if you're used to being the fixer in every relationship, the person who's responsible in your home. You know, you're the strong one, the big one. You're the person who pulls when everyone else is falling down in the mud.
I identify with that.
You're used to it and you want to keep, but don't. It doesn't pay off in the long run. There's no return on this investment for you. And you could be doing so much more for so many more people from such a better position if you just let go in those circumstances. And you might be saying, but how could I let go? I want to fix the situation so I can keep going. No, no, no. The idea is you should always be open to opportunities. Your resume should always be up to date. And you should always be going on informationals when somebody's like, oh, we should talk about X. You should just entertain opportunities by de facto, or as I like to use the expression, on principle. On principle, I am always open to new opportunities. If I am truly perfectly compensated in my role for what I'm capable of doing, then my job has no reason to fear that I will leave. If I talk with somebody and they say, we think you'd be great for this, here's how much we can offer you, I should be like, I'm being paid more than that where I am now, and I'm very happy, so I have no reason to leave. This is called capitalism working for the worker. And in tech, we're actually able to do this. It doesn't work in other things where there's a bunch of people who want the jobs and like only two jobs, but there are always more engineering and tech jobs. Always. Everybody wants to hire you and you're sitting here grinding away trying to fix a broken. No, 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 no. Stop. Stop taking responsibility for other people's bullshit. You're always open and it is 100% on the company to keep you. It's on you to do your absolute best by the company and your coworkers. Like, But I also do believe that you are doing the best that you can under the circumstances and with what you've been given, and that you are a person who is growing and learning and trying, and that the work that you do is honestly your best. And it should go both ways. So my advice for people is usually, you know, don't wait until you're miserable. You should actually, you know, just keep putting yourself out there, keep that resume up to date with your last three favorite projects, your wins. It actually really helps shape how you think about the work that you're doing in terms of, well, what story do I want to tell on my next interview round about this project I just launched? And that can really get you through some dark nights. I can go into that a little bit more too, but I've been monologuing for a bit. Jen, you want to hop in here?
I do, because there's two really important topics I want to talk about that I want to dig into more. One is that we have been told that we are responsible to fix the situation before we leave a job. And I responded to a tweet that you had about this, where I said, I was literally told this. I was literally told this in an interview when I said, I'm leaving for X reasons. They said, well, what did you do to fix the situation? And I said, I don't have the power to do anything. They said, no. You always try and fix it, or else that is a red flag for us.
That's a red flag for them. Yes, it really is a red flag.
It is a red flag, but not in that direction, my friend.
Right.
It also came with a healthy dose of sexism in that talk, because the person was worried that I was a gossip who just liked to gossip about what's gone wrong, but not actually try to fix it.
I love it how people come up with, like, you know, we've got man tissues and we've got a lady sport deodorant. And you know what? We have insider knowledge and we have gossip.
Yeah. Oh, isn't that an interesting framing choice?
It's a gendered form of insider knowledge trading. I mean, everyone does it, but for men, it's called something else. And for women, it's called gossip. By the way, gossip is one of the most valuable knowledge channels you can have access to. So I'm just saying, don't knock it until you tried it.
Yeah.
Training information about the good and bad behind the scenes, it really lets you know what you're getting into. And it is a survival technique for most minoritized people. You got to know what you're walking into. And if you go through traditional channels like the company report, you're just not going to hear, like, why did a bunch of people of color just leave this company? What's the story on the ground? Was it like one bad person that's being thrown out of the company, or what's going on? Go ask the white CEO. You're going to want to talk to someone who left the darn company, and they're going to tell you what they went through.
Yeah, exactly.
And if companies don't like it, they should treat people better.
Definitely. And that brings up the second point, which is people don't want to pursue opportunities when they're doing well at a company, or they like a company, or they've just joined a company, because they feel loyalty.
Oh, loyalty. Oh.
Loyalty to this job, loyalty to this company.
I feel like there's a Ferengi saying about how, like, loyalty is the sucker's form of not getting paid for mercenary work. I don't know. Loyalty is very problematic. It's trotted out an awful lot in circumstances where, what is it, the people who feel the most loyalty have the least to gain by it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, like, I'm a loyal shopper at this company. The company loves that you are loyal to it. It will do things to keep you loyal. But for the most part, your loyalty benefits them more than it benefits you. A company does not put a dollar in to get 80 cents out. If it puts a dollar into you, it expects you to give it $1.10 back. That's how it works. And feeling loyalty to the company you shop at, to, like, even a politician, like, to anything that isn't directly a person you can look over your shoulder at and say, hey, I see you. Loyalty to anything other than a flesh and blood human being you have access to, it's kind of misplaced. Conrad Lorenz ran these experiments on baby birds to get them to imprint, that is, to mistake the first thing they saw for their mother. And had many little geese following him around for many years in the 1960s. But there was this one experiment that was done on imprinting that just sticks with me forever, which was where baby ducks, ducklings, were imprinted on inanimate cardboard boxes. So they were hatched, and they were led to believe that a box had feelings for them and was their mother and cared for them. And the researchers could drag the box on along on a string, and the ducklings would give the duckling equivalent of, mom, mom, wait, don't leave me, mom, and chase after it.
That is so sad.
Yeah, right? And I see that. in the loyalty that people feel for their company. You know, like, oh, this company's been really good to me. I want to keep giving it my all. You know, things are going great right now. I should say, no, no, you're the duckling believing that the box cares about you.
What does that even mean? The company has been good to me. What does that even mean? They paid you adequately? They gave you benefits that made you be able to live your life and be healthy? Why did you think this wasn't something you were owed? Why do you think of it as like a benevolent gift from the company? It's not. This is how the transaction works. You give them work.
It's capitalism.
They give you the money and the benefits. And when they don't do that, do you stay with them? No.
Oh, that's a bad transaction for you. But I see people do it all the time.
All the time.
And I've also seen people not do it. I remember one of the big companies I worked at, I was talking with somebody after review season, and I was like, so what's going on here? This is all new to me, and what the heck is going, like, whoa. I'm still kind of amazed at how big companies work. And my friend informed me, this is where all the shakeups happen, because everyone who got promoted, this is a great time for them to move into another role on another team. Some managers don't want to promote people because that might mean they'll leave the teams. So they're just dangling the promotions in front of them to get them to work harder, work harder, work harder. Other people didn't get promoted, and they're really cross about this, and so they're also looking to change teams. But because they didn't get promoted, or they, you know, their numbers aren't good for such reasons, it'll be a harder sell to other managers because they might feel like there's a smell there. The best time for you as a worker to jump ship is when you're delivering your best work, when everyone is singing your praises and everyone is extremely happy. That is the best time. Because you're also extremely happy with your performance. You're feeling very confident. The people I've seen who've been really successful have always, what is it? They've cashed out their winnings before they play the next hand. And that is something we forget to do. You know, sell high, buy low. Remember, change always happens. If you have a couple of good hands, a couple of good years, good project releases, et cetera, like, you can only keep up until the writing that for so long. Eventually, there'll be a plateau. Eventually, there'll be a dip. So if you're thinking the good times will last forever, I'll just, you know, wait until somebody promotes me into another role, or, you know, my dream job just falls head over heels into my lap without me trying to do anything for it. No, no,
no.
When you're doing well, that is the right time to be telling people, yeah, I'm doing really well at work. What are you up to these days? Anything fun happening at your place? We should get a coffee. Then talk about the things you're excited about. Talk about the stuff you actually want to be doing, not necessarily the stuff you're being rewarded for doing. Share it often. Share it politely. Definitely always talk about the good and the things that you're proud of that have happened and been happening with you. And that's when the real opportunities start knocking at your door, because everybody loves a winner. So if you've shipped something awesome, if you're really proud of what your team's been doing, you should definitely be sharing those things. Because most people want somebody like that to do the same for them. And then opportunities will start coming to you. You'll be able to pick one that gives you that right balance of challenge and sameness for you to step into something that continues to grow you and make you happy.
Yes, look at opportunities when you're still doing your best work, when you're doing great things. Like you said, it's like a magnet for things coming along. And also, don't fall into this trap that you're doing good work at this company. So if you stay there and you keep doing good work, you will see the rewards, because as you said, change happens and you don't know when it's gonna happen. So I've seen a lot of people make the mistake of staying at a startup when things start to get a little iffy and being like, I'll be rewarded if I do X, Y, and Z and keep doing good work and stay through this difficult period. No, probably not. Maybe if you're a dude and a high profile dude in that company, but certainly not if you're underrepresented or minoritized, like sticking through the rough patches, maybe not what you should do at all. Like probably not.
There's a great book called Thinking in Bets. I highly recommend folks give it a listen or a read. And one of the techniques in there, and I think this is really good about getting real about risk, is try to put numbers on things and ask yourself how likely you are to take that bet. So if your friend is in this situation and the startup suddenly hit in some troubled waters, oh man. Well, you know, many startups do pull out of that tailspin, but it takes years. It takes years. So ask yourself, okay, if it were like this, how likely is it I could keep doing this for 1 year? Okay, maybe 80% likely. You might take that bet. What's your reward if you do that? Do you get more money? Is the company going to give you a bonus? Is the IPO just around the corner? What's the reward for making that bet? And if you look at the long enough time, and look at the other side too, like how long is it likely to take for this company to IPO, pull out of the trajectory it's on, et cetera? And if you're like, well, that's 4 years, and you realize that your likelihood of making it to the 4 year mark is only 20%, is that a bet you want to make? Is it worth the opportunity cost of taking yourself off the market for 4 years, burning out, being tired, being beaten down, only having sad stories, defeatist stories to tell on interview loops? And tell yourself going to bed every night, being like, oh, my team is struggling. I feel so bad. We're hemorrhaging people. What am I going to do to staunch? It is a downward spiral. And if you don't have the emotional capital to weather the storm, it doesn't make sense.
And when you do decide to leave, well, this is one of your points about don't wait until you're really done to start looking for your next opportunity. All that burnout, all those horrible stories, that makes it so much harder for you to suss out and look at opportunities.
Yeah.
It really can cloud your judgment. It also makes it harder for you just to interview.
Mm-hmm.
The worst interview cycles I always went through were at the very end of a job when I was burnt out or tired and just couldn't do anything anymore.
Yeah.
It's really hard. And you can't assess properly because I ended up taking jobs sometimes out of like feeling the need to have the next job lined up, but the opportunity wasn't the right one, but I still took it. And then I regretted it and I would leave that job pretty quickly. So
you want to be running towards something, not running away from something. And that's why you want to be open to opportunity when the times are good, when you're hale and hearty. You know, you will be in interviews where you will have to tell stories when things didn't work out, but you do need to tell stories when things were working out. And that is why leaving on the high note is great. Additionally, if you quote unquote leave on the high note, you are leaving the people behind in great situation. You know, you set them up to succeed. You have, you know, lots of exit interviews where you're just telling people how much you believe in them and you're encouraging them. And you can make it abundantly clear to everyone that you're not leaving because you don't believe in what they're doing or the company. You're just leaving because something amazing cropped up. And you're letting this kind of cosmic sorting order sort you forward. You're letting the winds build on each other and take you to the next bigger and bigger challenges. And you're avoiding internalizing stories of failure, of personal culpability for something that was failing anyway. Let's be real. Like that startup didn't fail because you didn't workshop team dynamics enough. It failed because people made bad decisions at tops. And you won't be there upset spreading. Honestly, let's be honest. When we're done, we're not pleasant people. Humans, when we are done and burnt out, we start burning people near us out. It's a sad thing the way a house catches on fire like that. When I know I'm done, I distance myself from other employees because I don't want it to spread to them. I want them to be happy. I want them to do their best. I don't want them to see me being like, that is not how I want them to remember me. I want them to remember the good times, the wins. And I want them to know, like, if they're ever struggling, they can come to me in the future. Like, these are my friends. But I also, like, I've got career coaches and professionals who can help me with my personal struggles. I don't need to be sharing them necessarily with my closest coworkers.
Yeah. So I've watched burnout spread like a wildfire in a company before and affect everyone. And a lot of people left at the same time. That definitely happens. And like you said, when you're in that, not just burnout, but when you're done with a company, when you're really ready, when it's not working for you anymore, but you have this line in the talk that you gave of you don't like who you are at work.
Mm-hmm.
That is a horrible place to be at. Why do we allow jobs to do that to us? Why do we let them affect us in such a great way? I've been in relationships that did that and that was poor. And then I also have allowed companies to do that.
We mistake our jobs for a relationship. We want to prove ourselves to this inanimate object we've mistaken for a father figure.
Our cardboard box.
I think you do need past, especially as I start entering into my more, I don't want to say advanced or senior or elder, but like as I've moved to the mid-career stage, I'm not quite to the twilight stage yet where I'm like passing on my knowledge to all the up and coming people who I'm going to. I will never have a seat of power like that in this world, but let's assume I did one day. Anyway, now that I'm about mid-career, oh, hold on. What were we talking about? I got caught up in that metaphor too much.
We treat our companies like relationships, our cardboard boxes that we go around being like, mother, don't leave me.
Yeah, your company is not your family. These people are not even necessarily your friends. Once you leave the company, most of your relationships will stay behind. Some of them will come with you. Those are amazing. Those are people you want to like keep in your life and your professional circle. I have people like that. And there are those people who will be real with me and be like, Rachel, I think there's an opportunity here you're not noticing. And yeah, I need that. But most of the people that you know, like, oh, but my workplace is like my family. I'm just going to say this, but you should have an actual family. Your coworkers are not a replacement for a social life, for friends and family outside the company. And the more stuck in that bubble your mind is and your head is, the more you'll cave into groupthink and the more you will internalize messages about what you should be. We're always shaped by the people around us. If you work with a manager who believes that arguments should be had and fought out in, you know, public meetings with all of the stakeholders watching to see who wins, that's the kind of person you're going to grow to be around that manager. And maybe that's not in alignment with your personal values, or maybe it is. I don't know. I can be a little wolfy some days, but you should have anchors outside your professional work persona. You know, you should have your therapist, you should have your family, you should have your besties who work in other fields like marine biology, and they will help anchor your sense of self outside what the company wants and needs you to be. Because if a company could purely shape you into what it needed, it would. And that wouldn't really be a person anymore. You'd be an automaton primed to deliver results to the company. And I've seen this happen.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll need a lot of therapy to undo that.
A lot.
A lot of therapy.
Because that's not a human anymore.
It's not a human who decided to be that person, at least. Like if you want to become a fierce trading floor warrior and that's been your dream since you were 12, okay.
I mean,
you know, like you do you. I'm into it.
A strange dream for a 12-year-old, but you know.
I wanted to be a chemist because it would make a lot of money.
I mean, also that sounds cool. I knew someone who was a chemist and she worked on actually like creating explosives. It was pretty cool.
Sounds awesome.
She blew up fire trucks for her job.
And you didn't meet that person at work, did you?
No, I did not. I met her in a bar.
There, see, being a real person existing outside your job is important. It also makes you a more interesting person to work with. And there's more to know about you than just like the numbers you reported at your last job, which, by the way, your numbers are great, but you know, your numbers don't make you who you are. They just tell the story of your value to the machine that's hiring you. You are you.
So I have sort of lost myself at a job, become a person I didn't really like at work. It can be really hard to know that it's happening to you. Do you have any advice for how you start to get a hold of that before it really starts to impact you?
Pay attention to how you're getting on with your friends. If you and your friends are slowly drifting apart or losing touch with each other, that means that you're changing, you're growing apart from one another. That's not necessarily a bad thing. You know, there's a story about the crabs that pull other crabs into the bucket. As we go through life, sometimes, you know, we're going in a different direction from our friends and our friends don't want us to. So they want to pull us back to where they are. That happens. But sometimes you'll see that you're growing apart from people you really care about and respect for reasons that align with your values. And if you are, you need to ask why that is. You might even have to sit a friend down and be like, I gotta be real with you. Like, we're not as close as we used to be. What do you think has happened? And that can be a really good indicator that you are fundamentally changing. For me, I can remember an instance where I asked somebody I had a very close working relationship with outside the company for a favor, and they didn't like the way that I asked them. It felt kind of imperious to them. And I realized that, you know, my situation has changed. This is not me being the little, you know, open source freelancer asking for a favor anymore. I'm in a different spot. I'm used to interacting with people in a different way now. And maybe that's not how I want to interact with people. Maybe this isn't how I want to engage with my colleagues outside this company. And maybe I have started to pick up too many of the traits of the people that I'm working with.
Yes, that's happened to me too. It was a really sad realization on my part. And that also I had, one, just adjusted to the environment I was in and picked up those habits from them. And then two, realized it was also a bit of a survival mechanism.
Yeah.
And you can't carry those from job to job. You can't keep carrying your survival mechanisms from job to job. You can't have them leak into your real life.
No. I mean, one thing you have to do between jobs, I recommend if you can do it, it's worth it. It's one of those things that if you can, spend 3 weeks between jobs, decompressing and offloading all the negative habits, you know, really scrubbing the ship's hull and putting on a new coat of paint before sending her out on her next voyage. If you can get that time and, you know, meditate, have some cram sessions with a therapist, if you've been burning out and skimping on them, spend this time trying to get back to your core self and trying to pick over the habits that you've picked up and been like, what has served me? What hasn't served me? What will serve me in this next challenge? If there's a next challenge, what do I want to carry with me into the next thing? It's a lot. I mean, some of these skills can be really good, you know, like learning how to assertively say something and not mitigate it after you've said it is a great skill. Mm-hmm. And maybe some of your friends will be like, you're so braggy or you're so arrogant. Well, maybe those friends aren't the most supportive friends in other ways too. And you should, you know, eye that with a little bit of evaluation. But in general, you have to shake yourself a bit and think about what kind of a person you want to shape yourself to be. And sometimes there's this a great book called Rising Strong, I think it is, by Tara Strong. Oh my God.
I'll find it and I'll put it in the show now.
Well, you know, I've got it right here on my Kindle. But there is a quote in here about how senior women, especially, you can't be liked as a high-powered woman in any situation. The whole system is set up that you can either be likable or you can be powerful, but you can't really do them both. And that if you want to have the power, which if you want to change the world, you should want power. And I think you should want to change the world because it can be a lot better than it is. And the only people who are actively changing it don't have your best interests at heart, I'll be honest. So you should want power and you should want to remake this world to suit you and suit the people you love. But that does mean that you might have to sacrifice being liked. You're probably raised with being likable as being your way of not getting taken to the teacher's office or not getting in trouble with dad or the cops. And being likable, just be likable. But eventually, as you try to move forward and move into the place to have more impact and change more lives and make this world a place you want to be an active part in, you're just going to have to level with the fact that some people aren't going to like that. Some people are going to have things to say behind your back about it. And there are coping mechanisms. I highly recommend that book, you know, like always starting with warmth, et cetera. You're going to have to manage how you behave around people so that you can navigate forward. And that can suck to have to change who you are on some levels. It'd be great if we lived in a world where you could be powerful as a minoritized person and not have to adjust yourself, but we don't live there yet.
We don't.
But we do need more people like you changing this world to get there.
And on that note, actually, we're at time, which sucks because I want to keep talking to you, as always. We never have enough time together. I want more.
No, we don't, Jen.
Do you have any final words of wisdom, final advice, final something you want to say before we officially sign off?
All right. I'm just going to do this as a soundbite in case someone's having a bad day. This is a lot to take in. So I'm going to bring it full circle right back to the beginning. Bet on yourself. You're your biggest advocate. You know yourself better than anybody else. Bet on yourself. Don't wait for other people to bet on you. Always go all in on yourself.
Bet on yourself. All right. Thank you for being here. Really appreciate it.
Thank you for being here, Jen. And thank you, wonderful listeners, for coming.
I'm so excited because I know at the end of this podcast, this particular episode, that you got so much out of what Rachel had to say. I know that you did. If you have anything that you got out of this that you want me to know about, my DMs on Twitter are open. Again, my handle is girlcode with a U. I'd love to talk to you. And with that, I will see you next week.